You learn that real very quickly on a farm. Out here, you're open to things all the time. Every part of you has to be. I mean, the people in the country have really taught me how to love again. You know, not just love myself or my family or my friends, but the love of the world. We've got people here. It sounds like an exaggeration, but they can't wait to get up in the morning. They love the change of climates. They, when it's 40 below out here, it's a kick to them. It's a challenge to them. You know, they get up. It's bracing, and I didn't have that feeling in the cities. When it was cold and you worried about your car wouldn't start, it was a drag. You know, you'd fight it. Not out here.
Song for a Widow's Marriage by Franklin Brainerd. Husband, I come to you no girl, but a woman earthed from North Dakota. I have known the farm, have milked cows, have forked manure into the spreader, have smelt the deep ammonia of horse urine. I have borne the womb burden. I have borne and bear the woes of children, woes that hang as unaccountable as moon dogs or a dry dipper. I come to you no girl, but I come rich with peasant blood and warm as sun-dug potatoes. You shall have me warm beside you when winter turns over the roof's edge. You shall have me like something hilled for winter, coming live with flavor from the double-doored root cellar. And when I take the pies from the oven, and when I take the bread that yeasted all the kitchen in the afternoon, come, kiss my neck, and walk with me through the late garden. The Farmer is the Man, as told by Meridelle LeSueur in her book North Star Country, published in 1945 by Duell, Sloan, and Pierce, New York. Excerpts from the articles, How Fred Andrews Tills the Soil with a Computer, Saturday Review Society, March 1973, and Oh, to be Back on the Farm by Stephen Petch, North Country Anvil No. 5. Poems by Franklin Brainerd, originally published in Northstone Review, and now included in his book Rain Gatherer, published by the Minnesota Writers Publishing House, 1973, and by Lewis Jenkins from a forthcoming book to be published by the same press. Music from the album So Early in the Morning and Anthology of the 12-String Guitar, both on the Tradition label, and Oscar Brand and Gene Ritchie, an archive of folk music production. And special thanks to Chuck Lilligren for reading the Dan Valentine verse, What is a Farmer? A Sense of Place, a documentary series which looks at regions and regionalism in the state of Minnesota. Produced by Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. This program is called Mining Music and Much Ado About Sports. A tourist, traveler, big city sophisticate, taking a long view from a car window at 60 miles an hour and listening to Frankie Yankovic on one of the local radio stations, might determine that the Minnesota Iron Range was a place of mining music and much ado about sports. And so far as his observations went, he would be right. But while he would be awed or appalled by the great ragged holes in the landscape, he would likely fail to wonder at the magnificence of the ore-rich earth. He would respond with curiosity and or amusement to the distinctive Iron Range accent that even radio announcers never quite overcome, but never consider the potpourri of European cultures that went into making the sounds of Iron Range voices unique, and the sentiments they express about the place they live so intense.
Rhythm it plays, and I know it will make you feel good. Tick, 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 tock goes my heart with the clock, cause they know I am dancing with you.
I don't think there's anything anywhere else on earth that measures up to it even. My wife doesn't believe me, of course, but she was born here just like I was, but I'm an outdoorsman. I love the winter season. I love the woods, the hunting, the fishing. In fact, when I got out of high school, I had no definite idea of what I wanted to do, you know, in college. I got into the service, and I began thinking that someday I'm going to have to go back, and what am I going to do for a living? And the first thing I knew definite was that I want to go right back to Virginia, Minnesota. And then I got to thinking about it. Well, what is the best job to have around there? Well, it's mining, because this is a mining area. So I went right to college, took mining engineering, and got a job right here in town, exactly what I wanted to do, and I'm still here. My business, mining engineering, is an outdoor job. It's a man's job, and a lot of challenges. This is one of the biggest mining areas in the world, and I'm a part of it. I love every minute.
Uniformity and closer cooperation from individuals. And we just think that this is probably the best place in the world to work. We at least know our next door neighbors and the people down the block. And that is really something, in my opinion. I've lived in other areas where you don't even find out who lives next door to you until the person dies and you read it in the paper.
One of the things that I feel is good for the kids, you know, to be in a small community and to be near their families or extended families or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a secure feeling, I guess. You know, when you know everyone in a community, and you know, some people might think it's terrible to have everyone know your business, but I kind of feel it's all kind of a, you know, like, well, with the kids, if they, you know, wander off, or if someone's in trouble somewhere, everyone knows who they are. Somebody will bring them home. Someone will, you know, report to me if they're doing something wrong.
Why? There's snow up here. I love winter. It's my favorite season. I drive a 650 Polaris Starfire with a Lubot close to 100 miles an hour, 97 or so. When you live in a city, I know I lived in Minneapolis and I went to school. And I was confined, it seemed, to Centennial Hall, and I could go for an hour driving and I'd still be in town. No matter if you were in the slums or in the high-class district of town or right downtown metropolitan area in the loop, you're still in town. There's only so many things you can do. There's nightlife, sure, but that gets dull after a while. You can go to museums, but who wants to go to a museum for excitement? You know, there's up here you can go in the woods. You know, you can go back to nature. The air is clean. I've got peace of mind in the woods. Ron and I, when we go out there, we can walk for 3 hours and not say a word to each other.
I guess you might say we pride ourselves or work hard at being very flexible. Like, you know, we enjoy the very nice things in life, whatever they are. You know, the finer things, you might say, the fancy things.
We're not typical rangers. We aren't. We, Ron and I both, we've you take the lowest person on the Iron Range, and we probably know them. And you take the upper elite socialite. We know the businessmen, we know the working man. We can go to the farm, for example, and reach in our kupus barrel, sauerkraut. We make our own sauerkraut, take it out with our hands, throw it on a plate, eat that with fried eggs. And yet at the same time, we can go down to any hotel or restaurant or bar on the range and act as refined as anyone that has been brought up in the city. More so, in fact, I think, because we don't put on airs.
A good example would be a few weeks ago we went to Chicago. One Saturday night we were having, well, it was 5 o'clock in the morning, we were having breakfast at the Playboy Club. And I think the following Sunday we were cleaning the outhouse at the farm. So we, like I say, we pride ourselves in being flexible. It's the fun in life.
Today, a lot about life on the Iron Range is fun. But yesterday, well, that's another story. Young people, new people, feel secure with the stable year-round economy of taconite production. But lifetime rangers have long memories. In her 1969 novel about the development of the Iron Range region, Minnesota author Margaret Culkin Banning alludes to tensions that began to surface with the first shovels of ore.
Some of the stories might be apocryphal, but the fortunes that began to be made were not. The tireless, dogged merits dug and tested, and at last came upon the great basin of ore they proudly named Mountain Iron. And there was no fable about that discovery, which touched off a far greater boom on the Mesabi than the one on the Vermilion Range had. The big men in the East let the merits have their glory, but inexorably they moved in to take possession.
Bill Ojala is a state representative from the Iron Range. He is of Finnish descent. When workers first began to band together to gain better conditions in the mines, his people were in the forefront of the movement and the first to feel the brunt of the mining company's power.
Even as early as 1907, a number of Finns were in the forefront of that particular strike. Were organizers, perhaps, of strike activity, of attempted organization of the miners themselves. And certainly in 1916, they were very much in the front ranks of the strike as it developed spontaneously. I think it was in June of 1916. The IWW moved into the range in 1916, not to organize the strike, but in response to requests of striking miners for assistance in planning and organizing and developing the strike. I think they had been turned down by the Western Federation of Miners, so they went to the IWW for help. But I think the story of that 1916 strike will show that it developed spontaneously in the St. James Mine in Aurora, and that news of the strike was carried by a young Finn who ran from Aurora the length of the range, shouting the news that the strike is on, and spontaneous walkouts took place along the length of the range. I think eventually 16,000 miners were on strike. And the mining companies responded by blacklisting many of the people involved in the strike, workers involved in union organization, and this is why you found that, or you find that so many Finns left mining and went out to farm a 40 or 80 acre tract out in the countryside because they were refused work by the mining companies. And you also find that many Finns were on the payrolls of local municipalities, school districts, as custodians and janitors because they were unable to find work with the mining companies.
Other immigrant groups did somewhat better, but distrust of the decision makers, the company hierarchy in Duluth and in eastern cities prevailed. Bruno Scipioni is the son of an Italian miner and is himself employed in the industry as a mining company engineer in U.S. Steel's Mintac plant in Mountain Iron. He suggests that many of the antagonisms were carryovers from life in the old country.
It used to be that everybody on the range thought of anybody who lived in Duluth as being a rich person, people with money. And here we were peasants up here, miners, struggling. Everybody thought they were abused, you know, by the mining companies. And there was a lot of personal abuse, assaults on human dignity, but it wasn't just unique to the mining company. That was a common attitude towards labor throughout the country. But these people were feeling sorry for themselves around here, and they figured anybody in Duluth was either a rich timber man or a rich mining man. And I think a lot of it stems from the fact that with this European background that we all have, you know, in Europe, if you come from a village 5 miles away from the other, from another village, they're complete strangers and bitter enemies. That's a vast distance. So they dislike one another. They distrust one another. And I think maybe some of that carried on here. Duluth, why, that's just like the other side of the globe. You can't trust those people.
Now, of course, Duluth is a service center for the range, providing shopping, financial, medical, and educational facilities, as well as television stations bringing in news of the world, the nation, and coverage of activities of the entire northeastern Minnesota region. Duluth sportscaster Bob Junkert has done play-by-play on hundreds of Iron Range sporting events, and he has some thoughts on why sports are such a big thing in the area.
You have towns that are 4 or 5 miles apart. For example, the Eveleth, Gilbert, Virginia area, you have three high schools all within about a 4 mile area of each other. There's tremendous rivalry among those schools, and of course, the various settlements that came from the old country, the different nationalities that settled, were all very proud. And I think this all carried through to high school athletics as they participated. It's an intense rivalry. As an outsider, when you go up and you talk about the range, now you're fighting the entire range. You say one word against the range, you're fighting it all the way from the east end to the west end. But they among themselves will battle with bitter, bitter rivalry in athletics or whatever, I suppose, city government. But athletics is where they keep score, so that's why they go out. And I have never heard cheering, screaming, yelling like you do on the iron. I sometimes feel sorry for the opposition that has to go in. That is, the outside opposition. The Rangers among the Rangers, of course, they're used to. Professional ranks, so therefore they were able to make a living by playing hockey. And as time went on, way back in the 30s, for example, Lud M. Dalsik coached St. Cloud at that time, and there were scholarships available for range boy, for any boy for that matter, but a lot of range players, because that's where they did play hockey ahead of just about everyone else in the upper Midwest and high school level. So even then, in the mid-30s, early 30s, there were scholarships available for hockey players. And I think, yes, there is a correlation between parents wanting their son to be an athlete or a hockey player, perhaps specifically with the hope in mind that he would get a college education as a result of it.
Ask Rangers about sports and you get another perspective.
I guess that's the only thing that the rivalries are strong as in the sports area. I mean, you know, we're all kind of interdependent on each other for a lot of things. We have to depend on Virginia for a lot of, that's the only place we have to shop and do our business. You know, we don't have a very large business community in Mount Mayer. But in sports, it's just, people are sports crazy around here. Just absolutely insane. Over every, I don't care what it is. And of course, in Mount Aaron, we had our big state football championship and all kinds of big things. Like, if we can beat Virginia in anything, that's just the greatest thing in the world. It's really pretty competitive. And yet, the kids in all the towns, and as I remember in high school, they're really terrific. You can kind of get to know a lot of the kids from the other schools. I mean, I just knew so many people that, you know, I still will see that I knew from all the different towns around that you get to know through all these, you know, inter-school functions and everything. And some of them to come, you know, where you get to be very good friends. And so it's not to the point of being hostile.
Sports is a big deal up here because we have so many people who devote
once more
so much of their own time for nothing to kids and to the youth program. That this is why sports are so big up here.
Kids, families, friends, schools, jobs, and how it was in the old days. Vital concerns on the Iron Range. Basic concerns that have insulated the region in an era of change. Somehow, every conversation eventually gets back to these themes.
You know, when we were little youngsters, little kids, by the time we learned to walk, well, a few years later, we were climbing around these mining headframes. These were all underground mines in those days, like in 1920s. And our pastime was crawling between the ore cars and climbing these mining headframes and swimming in the potholes, the little ponds that were made from the runoff backed up against an old mine dump. And God, it was a child's paradise up in these small villages, you know.
And you lived in a mining village, too.
Yeah, we lived in a mining village. We didn't live in town. We lived in the village of Franklin out here. And we had nothing, really, when you think of it. We lived in the village up there with no running water, no facilities of any kind, no police protection, no grocery stores, nothing. You were dependent on your own ability to raise food in the garden and handle a few cows. And we had a grocery delivery, I think, twice a week from a cooperative store. I'm Italian, you know. And all of the Italians had an Italian workpeople's store, which was a cooperative. And this manager who ran the store had a small Model T at the time. And he'd make a round of each one of these little villages twice a week, and he'd deliver groceries. And our fathers worked in the mine when work was available, and this was our existence.
This was during the Depression, too.
Yeah, this was...
And the women, in order to help their families, would have fresh butter made and different things that they would give to this fellow when he came around with the things that they needed, the staples. They would trade off their home-churned butter and their cheese. And maybe eggs from chickens. Yeah. And this sort of thing, too.
We were very, very poor, but none of us as children ever knew that we were poor because of the fantastic ability of our mothers to make food out of anything.
The mothers were just great.
He lived to the east of my parents, and between the two of us was my grandmother.
Well, give her the whole story now, how the Zuniches and the Matiches feuded.
For years and years, I don't know why.
His father's family and his mother's family feuded, and there was a fence dividing the 80 acres, and neither dare cross. And this was like 40 years ago, maybe 40 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
If his mother's father knew that she married a Zunich, which was on the other side of the fence, he'd turn over in his grave.
The only time that I remember my father telling me that his father-in-law, my mother's father, talked to him was when he had him drive the car when they were running moonshine. One time even, I guess the feds came after them or something, and he put the shotgun behind my father's ear and said, "Keep driving, kid."
I think the mining companies were quite successful initially in keeping these various nationality groups apart and, you know, antagonistic toward each other. And it was through this way that they really forestalled any attempts at organization, because if you had the Finn fighting the Austrian mad at the Italian, obviously you were not going to get any successful workers' movement developing. But over the years, this faded. In 1916, some of the magazines showed just the attitude of the mining companies. I think one of the Is it Nation or Survey Graphic has an article by a woman who toured the range in company of a mine superintendent, and she had not a kind word to say about any nationality group on the range. The Finns were radical in their politics, the Slovenians were dirty habits, and the Italians were poor workers, you know, just unkind cuts to every nationality group, and this obviously came from the mining companies. And it was through this that they, I think, tried to keep these groups apart, but you can't keep people apart forever, and eventually the workers overcame that and were successful in organizing.
The mining companies did a great thing with these guys when they put them to work. They would not put two Italians to work together, or two Finns, or two Slavs. They would mix them and force them to use English. As a result, the men spoke much better English than the wives, because the wives were at home all day using their native language, you see.
So if you took a personal IQ, especially on language, in this particular area here, you would find that there are numerous and great many people that can speak as many as 3 and 4 different nationalities. Much of this was learned back in the history of underground mining years ago, where your partner might be an Italian or he might be some type of Slovenian, Czechoslovakian, so you must learn to talk each other's type.
But all them old-timers are dying off. We made a count the other day. I think we got 3 left. I like to go talk to them once in a while, just for practice. But there's only 3 left, but then they want to talk English all the time.
Immigrants came over here and they retained this foreign way of living and manner of speech and outlook on life even.
But they passed it on to their children, your generation, and you can still make wine the old way. You can do many things that your dad did the same way that he did them, but your sons can't do it.
No, you see, you're going to lose that. And you could never, I could never instill it in my sons. Uh-huh.
They weren't interested.
They weren't interested, and then you're speaking the English language all the time, and you think differently. When you speak English, you think English or American. Mm-hmm. When you speak Italian, you think Italian.
It has been said that a visit to the Iron Range is like a trip to another country. Here's how Margaret Culkin Banning describes it in her book, Mesabi.
The towns of the Mesabi Range had grown out of their ugly infancy and now were pretty villages, at least in summer and autumn. The towns looked in many ways like average American provincial communities, which had no hopes or ambitions to become great cities, but were content to be county seats where fairs could be held and farmers dispose of their cattle and produce. But the man-made hills around them and the gigantic pits at the town limits made them forever different. In half a century, the waste material had built up to mountainous heights, which were squared off at the tops with a strange neatness. The landscape was not agricultural. It was what it had been for probably 2 billion years, an iron formation. The villages differed from other municipalities, too, because they could not control their own destiny. A mayor who was ambitious for change or an active chamber of commerce did not have the same opportunities that were available elsewhere. The local people could go just so far. Something feudal clung to the feeling of the region, although the term was obsolete and the old disregard for human rights had disappeared. But it was still true that what was going to happen to the range towns was decided in office buildings in eastern cities.
At some point in the not-too-distant past, a group of men meeting in an eastern city decided that taconite was a viable, albeit expensive, solution to the depletion of the region's raw ore reserves. A manufacturing process, taconite production demanded workers with specialized technical skills, thereby closing out many of the older miners and forcing the young ones to take additional training or to find other jobs, probably outside of the area. Still, taconite plants operate year-round, providing range communities with a sense of security unknown in all the years before.
I can't imagine that, you know, U.S. Steel would put up this fantastic plant, and it really is fantastic, and spend the amount of money they did, and possibly more in the future. I mean, this can grow, and, you know, and they have plans for just so many years ahead of time that I can't imagine right now that we're in that situation. But at one time when the mines, you know, they would mine a mine and then they would, you know, reach a point where it was no longer feasible to mine this mine and it was another place, and the mines would close in the winter and all this. That was a time, I guess, when people probably, it was tough to live here and know that they controlled everything, even your economics and it. But I just don't feel that we have that feeling anymore.
The range is changing. There's more people moving in from other areas with taconite. See, when the construction of the plant started, companies from all over the United States came here and they brought their own men with them. Well, then when the construction ceased, a lot of them stayed here and got employment at the steel plant. So the things have changed since, I would say 1965. But up until then, you knew everyone. You knew everyone's problems. If there was something going on, you know, derogatory, you knew about that.
Work life for these people, previous to taconite, of course, their existence was a seasonal one. You worked in the summertime and you did not in the winter. Now with taconite, that's changed, and I am absolutely amazed that they had a meeting out at Pittsburgh, and this was about a month ago, where the steel industry and the union leaders sat down together and they agreed that in order to meet this foreign competition, they had to get together and do something about the productivity of the working man, because we were being wiped off the map by the Japanese and the Germans and the Austrians and the Swedes. They could manufacture steel and sell it here cheaper than we could make it right in our own home backyard. And the labor chieftains agreed with the leaders of the industry that it behooved both management and labor that they are going to have to get together and do something about improving productivity. And we are now having meetings here with union people, and they are agreeing that they're going to have to do something about improving their productivity, and management is going to have to do something about making the job a little more comfortable. Now, this is a real breakthrough, I think, to get union people to admit that they have to probably work a little harder for their company.
Where I'm still living, and I think I would like to just to have the mining companies acknowledge that they've made a hell of a lot of money up there, and that they owe some responsibility to maintaining municipal services, a substantial share of the cost of educating the kids. Just some acknowledgement of that responsibility on their part, and a willingness to deal with us. After all, I'm the elected representative of District 6A. I've been elected to public office, county commissioner, and have them come to us as elected representative of the people, rather than try to make their deals in the back room of a hotel in Duluth with representatives of the Iron Range Municipal and Civic Association, which is really not the, you know, the body that's going to ultimately determine policy anyway. I'd like to have more openness, really, in discussion with these people, have them come out openly and honestly and talk about their problems, their aims and objectives, so that we can maybe be of some assistance, too.
The fifth part of A Sense of Place is continued on the other side, side two of the third cassette.
From the first understanding that the range's red earth was rich treasure, to the sophisticated process that turns out taconite, all in the space of less than 100 years. Jim Klobuchar, columnist for the Minneapolis Star, grew up in Ely. On the occasion of the closing of the last underground mine in his hometown in April of 1967, he wrote the following. It seems to sum up a lot of what can be said about the past and the future of the entire Minnesota range.
The red earth catacombs that have been burrowed 1,000 feet under my hometown by generations of helmeted miners are silent today and soon will be sealed forever. I trust there was no formal observance of the closing of the last underground iron mine in Ely. The Iron Range never did produce a trumpeter who could play Auld Lang Syne in four languages. Beyond this, the only functions certain to draw crowds in the range are Yugoslav picnics, come-as-you-are Finnish steam baths, and the appearance of a random faith healer from Duluth. Of the half-dozen underground mines that spilled millions of dollars' worth of ore into the country's blast furnaces for more than a half-century, the remnants in Ely now are empty tunnels, dead earth. The town will survive, partly because the underground successor of the taconite industry is operating nearby, and partly because the lakes and forests have outlasted the steam shovels, and the tourists will be there when the iron miner is gone. And so the red smudge skeleton of the abandoned mining shaft is not the town's headstone as it might have been years ago, before the years of Social Security, mining company pensions, and unionization. But while there may be future mining in the river-seamed hills near the town, the vermilion treasure that helped mechanize the nation has vanished. With it, I'm sure, must go part of the community's personality. Until diluted by a stubbornly advancing civilization decades ago, it was the miniaturization of the brawling frontier, peopled by lumberjacks, miners, and wenches. But later, the grime of its tunnels and the babble of its old world languages congealed into some tough fibered essence of the American vision. The industrialists had their millions from its vaults, and the immigrants had their dignity and the future of their children. It may be well to remember that in a period of screaming protesters and whining beatniks, there are still people around to whom the language at the foot of the Statue of Liberty was and is more than a parody. And so an immigrant who arrived at Ellis Island 60 years ago with his name flapping from his lapel for the inspectors and fright in his eyes could live to see his son earning a rich man's salary as a scholarly researcher in space age electronics. The era of the underground iron mine ends in northern Minnesota with no grievous enmity between the companies and the workers. There were walkout shutdowns and politicking, but no enduring hatreds. The mining companies exploiters once in the fashions of the times, later had no stomach for it, and finally, no opportunity for it. They matured, as did the pick-swinging miner, and today they are spending millions, or they are not required to provide for and resettle the men who raised the earth. For the men, the mines were a culture and a condition of life by themselves. They were their banks, their town halls, their prisons, because there was nothing else for them, and for a few of them, their graves. Nobody had any secrets in those moist, cool ore drifts where the minister's Sunday sermon underwent a blunt and enthusiastic critique each week. There were very few pretensions. You got along in whatever language was convenient. I knew an Italian grocer who listened to 6 a.m. Mass in Slovenian, ordered his beer in Finnish, and for all I know, romanced in Swahili. The ore stockpiles were the playgrounds of the kids, their ski slopes in the winter, and their badlands for cowboys and crooks in the summer. People around town knew what the 15th level was producing at the Zenith Mine, and they knew what the emergency siren meant in the middle of the afternoon. The idea of a college education for the children was an obsession with many of them, and the reason they resisted when the son would plan to go underground to help raise money for it. Once you go down there, they would say, you will never get out. But many did, of course. And yet, as the symbol of the youngster's arrival to manhood in this mining community, whatever he planned to do in the future, there was nothing with quite the emotional jar of the day he strapped on a helmet and battery and descended into the cool red tunnels with his father. Some of the ghosts in the town are not sad ones.
Music from the Polka Party album by Frankie Yankovic and from the Heart to the Heart album by the Graco Recording Orchestra. Excerpts from the novel Misabi by Margaret Culkin Banning, published by Harper and Row. Special thanks to Jim Klobuchar for reading his column. A Sense of Place, written and produced by Claudia Daly for Minnesota Educational Radio, under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. Engineering by Jerry Vanek.
Newspapers on the frontier were less concerned to inform the communities in which they were published about their activities than they were to inform people back east about what a great place the particular frontier settlement was. And so the newspapers on the frontier sent their papers back in exchange for eastern papers, and in the hope, regularly realized, that they would be reprinted in the eastern papers and that the things that they had to say about the territory would encourage migration to Minnesota.
The days of really flamboyant reporting are kind of over, because when you had flamboyant papers, you had essentially flamboyant people. And I think when the nation was still virtually a series of frontiers, people did kind of very unconventional and sometimes risque, perhaps irresponsible things that were extremely colorful, and consequently the coverage of them was very colorful. I think the Pioneer Press today, like all newspapers in the country, is a considerably more sober paper. And but I would say it's primarily a sober paper because it's reporting on the lives of people who are generally more sober people. I'm basically interested in bringing about change and, you know, the cliche of making it a better world. You aren't going to get any change unless first you get ideas about a direction. Where are we going to go? And I think that's what the media should do, is suggest directions, and having done that, present arguments why we should go that way. And it may take 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 years, depending on the particular goal that you take. And some days they're very short goals, and some days they're very far-ranging goals. But the point is that the populace is not going to elect men to move the country in a particular direction, or move a county in a particular direction, or even a city or a school board, until they have some concept in their mind of where they're going to go.
A Sense of Place, a documentary series which looks at regions and regionalism in the state of Minnesota, produced by Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. This program is called All the News That's Fit. Where are we going to go? James Madison Goodhue, when he issued the first edition of the state's first newspaper, the Minnesota Pioneer, in April of 1849, seemed to have little doubt. We, our ancestors, were going to go to Minnesota if he had anything to say about it. We were going to come out here to the free, fertile, healthful Northwest. And he asked, is it too much to predict for this young territory a rapidity of growth unparalleled even in the annals of Western progress? Once here, of course, he would not hesitate to instruct us as to where our political interests should lie. George Hagee, University of Minnesota Journalism Professor.
He sized up the political situation very quickly and allied himself with the political forces of Henry Hastings Sibley. He became a partisan of the Democratic faction led by Sibley, and there were bitter battles with another faction led by Rice. In addition to being, really more important than being a partisan, a political partisan of Sibley's, he was a promoter of the territory. Because Goodhue was a colorful writer and a vigorous writer, his articles about Minnesota Territory were quite frequently reprinted in Eastern papers, and this stimulated quite a bit of correspondence to him. People back east would write and ask specific questions.
In his book, Newspapers on the Minnesota Frontier, Hagee recorded Goodhue's enticing descriptions of the region.
St. Paul, which is the principal commercial town on the Mississippi, is situated upon a bluff some 75 or 100 feet above the river on its outward sweep, commanding a view of the stream for a distance of some 2 miles. The face of the country in the rear, that is, north of the town, is quite uneven and is made up of oak openings, mirrored by numerous little ponds. St. Paul has about 800 inhabitants, most of whom have sprouted up within the last few months. We have already most of the material comforts of life. We are usually visited by 4 steamboats a week, and Galena, Dubuque, and St. Louis, though the latter town is some 800 miles south of us, seem like neighbors. Their citizens frequently drop up to make us a call. His competitors, other newspaper editors, readily admitted that he had done more to promote the territory than anyone else in the community. So, yes, I think that the people on the spot in St. Paul did feel that he was an effective spokesman who gave them a sense of loyalty and pride and commitment to building St. Paul and the territory.
And so it began. Not only the building of a city or territory, but the building of a communications network that would seek to inform and influence the lives of the people who had come to Minnesota. In time, newspapers in the Twin Cities became more sophisticated, if less colorful, But to this day, a quaintly provincial tone remains in many papers in other regions of the state. Archie Selyards has been a reporter for the St. Paul Pioneer Press, a direct descendant of the original Goodhue newspaper, and presently serves as editorial writer for the Duluth Herald News Tribune. He offers some insights about the journalistic process in smaller communities.
If you're writing about a utility or a judge or a police chief or whatever in a community of this size, which is 100,000 people, your comments are more likely to be taken on a personal basis. And I guess to go more to the heart of the matter, in a larger community, there is more of a willingness and just a simple inclination on everyone's part to make this distinction between a person as a professional and a person as a person. And it's much more easy to run a newspaper and do some of the things that newspapers should do in a larger community, because most of your critical and investigatory efforts would be done on a professional plane. Duluth sits between the Iron Range, and which is about 60 to 70 miles north of here. Into the south we have Superior, Wisconsin, and though we would like to, we try, by way of editorials and news stories, to develop a regional metropolitan concept for Superior and Duluth, we have an underlying feeling that the readers in Superior perhaps look at this as Rankinism, and that precisely the opposite way to get something done, or the wrong way to get something done in Superior, is to suggest to Superior how it should do something. Because any opponent simply has to say, are we going to let those people in Duluth tell us how to run our city? Similarly with the Iron Range. The Iron Range is mainly the district where taconite and iron ore is dug out of the ground, and Duluth gains benefit of that merely by virtue of our sitting at the head of the lakes where the ore has to come through here to get on boats. And consequently, there's an ongoing animosity. But we believe that primarily by humor, I suppose, is a continual personal face-to-face effort that we can get these regions together. You can't do it by editorial or news story. By that type of effort alone, we have to physically go to Superior and meet people there and talk to them. We physically go to the Iron Range, or people there come down and talk. And when you get to know each other, it's similar to international affairs. If you get to know each other on a personal basis, then whatever concepts for unity you can convey in the newspaper, you not only get to a person's head, but if you've talked to his heart, the union will come.
Where are we going to go? Print journalists no longer have the field to themselves, but Selyards believes they have a unique opportunity to suggest what the direction might be.
In terms of setting direction, if you have a compass and you want to pick a direction, you hold that in your hand very steady, and you look at it, and you concentrate, and you find a direction point, and you look at it again and verify. And I kind of see a newspaper like that, where it will stand still and you can get your ideas together and debate with yourself whether this is a good direction or not.
The advent of radio in the 1930s and 40s provided an additional means of putting people in touch with what was happening in their communities, their region, their state. But while radio struggled to develop its own style of disseminating information, it borrowed, or as some might say, stole freely from the established print medium. In 1943, University of Minnesota journalism professor Mitch Charnley helped create the first radio news operation at WCCO in Minneapolis. And about the same time, Jim Payton was working at WEBC, the original radio station in the Duluth Superior market. Their experiences were remarkably similar.
There was the better feeling between the two, between the print and the air, and for a long time, I think we were guilty of this to some extent. When the morning paper, the first edition of the morning paper would come out, it would come out just about the time our evening news was getting ready, and we would always rush out to get it to see whether their headlines had been the same as our headlines and all that, and try to decide whether we'd done better than they. And for a long time, the papers wouldn't even mention broadcasting.
It's almost humorous. The first arrangement in 1930 that we officially made with the management of the Duluth Herald News Tribune come about after we established studios in Duluth, Minnesota. Previous to that time, WEBC was exclusively Superior in operation. The first agreement, or rather a tenuous thing, with a Colonel Henry, was the gentleman's name at the Duluth News Tribune, was, he said, you can come over and take some of those dupes off our Associated Press or United Press, I forget which it was, and take them out of here. You can also take a few dupe of local stories if the reporter wants to make the dupe available to you. I'm not going to brook them because they look upon you people with a little bit of a jaundiced eye anyway, as radio nuts was the usual expression.
At that time, Cedric Adams was the best-known radio newsman in the area, and Cedric would rush into the studio at 9:45 with the Evening Star or the Journal in his pocket, and he'd, as he got into the studio, he would open the paper and look at it, and he'd see some things he wanted, and he would that would be the basis of his broadcast, and he was a genius at that level. You know, there are low-level geniuses and high-level geniuses. And he really was a genius because he knew how to take the news, and he was pretty accurate, and to put his personality into it. We had a problem with Cedric because Cedric said, look, I can do this. Look how high my ratings are. Look how much money I bring in. I can do it. And Sig and Jocelyn and I said, that isn't good enough. We're going to improve what you do. And so we had quite a time to persuade Cedric to let us write his copy for him. There was a struggle there. But after, I suppose it took 2 months, something like that, and he discovered that we could write copy that he could use and that we somehow were able to catch his personality.
Bit by bit, radio, as such, established itself as an authentic news source. All of this, of course, albeit that in the morning we took shamelessly the Duluth News Tribune and read it verbatim. The papers, of course, were up in arms over the thing. They didn't want to say anything publicly because it's like they sort of hoped that radio was going to go away anyway. And they didn't like to call attention to the fact there was a media called radio. So they didn't say anything about it in the papers, but privately, they let our owners and our managers, and in many instances, staff know. And, of course, we lied, which was the simplest thing to do. But as I say, I did that hundreds of times. You would always put a little X with your black pencil over the stories you're going to read, and then put a line down at the end of the paragraph where you were going to stop. So that if you looked at an issue of the Duluth News Tribune at 10 o'clock in the morning in the studio of the WEBC, it was pretty well X'd up because you'd given them pretty much the news.
Austin Jocelyn was a manager of WCCO Radio, and he was a man who got the view that not very many broadcast managers have ever gotten. That news was something by itself, and that a good news operation had to be, first of all, a good news operation. And when he described to Sig and me what he wanted done there, he said, I will never put my nose in this newsroom. And he couldn't. He said, I'm hiring you because I think you're news people. And so we had that flavor. My news friend, my print friends, used to snigger at me when I would put on a radio news show. But all that, we got over that.
When television added picture to voice transmission, it added another element as well. News people found themselves with a burden and responsibility they hadn't had to contend with before, adequately serving a vast geographical area and doing it through a medium that was to become the most powerful communications tool of the era. Today, northeastern Minnesota is served by three television channels, all located in Duluth. It is perhaps the most interesting market in the state, since fierce competition for ratings and advertising dollars have demanded of each outlet a kind of excellence not normally found outside the Twin Cities. Locally originated newscasts are produced with concern for feeding the information hunger of the entire region, as if life depended on them. And indeed, because television is such an expensive medium, the life of each station depends in large measure on the ratings its news programming can muster. Don LeMessurier has worked in Duluth Television since the first VHF stations went on the air in the mid-50s and is presently program director at WDSM-TV. Dick Gottschild is news director at WDIO, the ABC affiliate which went into operation in 1966.
In the earlier, before pre-TV days, the most of the media were hometown media. Radio, each city had a station, each city had a newspaper. There was no media that really crossed all of the boundaries and served all of the people in the region. Television, because there are fewer stations, I guess, does that now. One television station in Duluth, for instance, has the capability of talking to a million people. And of course, no media before could have done that. So, in 1954, actually, when the VHF stations came in, suddenly there were a million people who were served by one central communication source. Previously to 1954, there was, of course, the UHF station, but UHF range is not such that people could see it far away and on the range and in Wisconsin and so on. So it was really the VHF stations that created an area-wide communications media.
I think that people have probably become acclimated to watching the tube because of the short summers and the long winters and not much else to do at night, and you get into a habit of watching the tube, and maybe you become addicted a bit to it. And television news in this market is well done, much better done than the print journalism that comes out of this market. And I think that a typical television news viewer is probably just as well or maybe a little better informed than the viewer that reads the newspaper in Duluth, Superior, in this area. I'm not sure that we should attempt to compete with the print media, but in this market we do. And we do so successfully because of two reasons. Number one, all three television stations are running good news operations. They're running what I would consider to be outstanding small market news operations, all three stations. Another thing is the newspapers in this market are not strong. They're not investigative. They're not probing. And I think that this has had an effect on what the television or what the news reader, viewer, the person who seeks news and knowledge does with his time.
Why the quality? I don't know. Quality has been a thing that the broadcasters in this market have sought after for a long time. When we first went into television here, we looked very hard at our closest neighbor, which was Minneapolis. And Minneapolis does things so very well. And so everyone in Duluth sort of patterned themselves after the Minneapolis market, not realizing we were too small to do it that well. Had a lot of help because we had good, close, long-time associations from those people. And we were able to pattern procedures, and then especially in the news area, after those Minneapolis stations. And as I say, we didn't realize that we're too small to do that. We're not supposed to succeed that well. And of course, once you start, the competition among yourselves gets to be fierce. And because your competitor does things very, very well, in order not to look terribly bad, you have to do them almost as well, or try at least. So it's been competition that has made any quality that we have.
WDIO television in 1966, about 4 months after we went on the air, decided that we were going to go into the news business. And I guess maybe more than anyone else, I was able to convince the management that they should make the commitment and spend the money. And I told them it would be very expensive, and it is. It's almost too expensive. And in the ensuing years, we hired good staff people and went into a television news operation. And up until that time, the market had been seeing radio news being read into television for the most part. I worked at a television station, another television station in the market, and we were trying, but we didn't exactly know what we were doing. And I think that combined with the emergence of television as a news form in the country, combined with this and the intense competition that was fostered by the arrival of the third television station in the market, trying to do a good job of reporting news, I think that is what moved this market into prominence and almost saturation of electronic journalism. I guess that the most that we can expect is to inform. And if that accomplishes that purpose of pulling the region together, that's good. I'm not sure that it does. I'm not sure, but maybe good journalism sometimes tends to divide. Our area in northern Minnesota has just suffered tremendously from a lack of people and a tremendous out-migration that I don't think anybody has really carefully cataloged. One of the reasons they haven't is because I think they're afraid to see what their actual results are. The young people have just gone, they've vanished. This is an old market. And I don't think that television journalism has accomplished anything in the area of pulling the whole region together. I can't see that that's happened. I think that the people in International Falls are probably a lot more aware of what's going on in Duluth.
The sixth segment will continue on cassette number 4.